Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies brought to you with the support of the ICON Research Center at the University of Warwick. This is part 2 of episode 20, where we discuss high reliability in practice, loosely focusing on an article by Carl Weick and Caroline Roberts from 1993 called Collective Mind in Organizations, Heedful Interrelating on Flight Deck. A classic article that explores many of the very interesting themes related to sense-making, knowledge, and, high reliability, obviously. For part one, we had a special guest, Rear Admiral retired Tom Mercer from the US Navy, who shed a lot of insight into how he managed an aircraft carrier on which actually this study that is in this paper was conducted, so that's pretty amazing. Do have a look at it if you haven't yet. Now, we are recording part 2 because we lost the original part 2 to a technical error. So, that happens. But because of that, we get to have this all-new discussion with Ralph. So, my name is Dimitris, coming to you for the very first time from my new office at the University of Sussex in Brighton.
And my name is Ralph, and I'm coming to you from Albuquerque, New Mexico, in the high desert.
So, yeah, stuff happens, doesn't it?
Yes, indeed. Personally, I think of this as a feature, not necessarily an error recovery. It's part of that reliability and resilience I think our podcast tries to emulate from high reliability organizations.
Yes, indeed. And in terms of guest value, surely we're not at a loss. We have you. You're extremely experienced and knowledgeable in this.
You are very kind. I've, and from my own perspective, I tend to think of this as a bonus, not a loss.
Yeah, surely. It was a fascinating discussion that we had with Tom, and listening back to it and while editing, especially, I realized how many themes he covered while just going over the things that he described to us. I even recommended this episode to some of my colleagues to use for teaching, because I found that it's exceptional in having students identify management themes that we normally teach them in the classroom. And Tom just mentioned a million of them, just casually talking about his experience. That was really fun.
I think it's a good idea, because it's one thing for students to hear the theories described and the basis for the theories, and it's quite another to hear someone who has many years of experience describing what he and the people he worked with actually did. And then from that description, they're thinking about what theories apply or what theories he has in use. And that may be not only more practical, but a way for the theories to resonate more with students. So I think that was a great idea that you suggested.
Right. And I mean, you invited Tom, so thank you. And it does kind of cover what we discussed with Henry Mintzberg back in episode 14, where he talked about that, you know, you can't learn management in the classroom, you need experience. And of course, listening to our episode is hardly an equivalent, but it does approximate the difference between classroom learning and kind of being there and doing these things.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that's partly because we try to bring in practice whenever we can. And both you and Pedro often bring up ideas that you've seen in observations or in organizations you've been part of. And I think that those descriptions of what you see lend a lot of color and interest to some of the theories we're talking about. Not that they're not interesting in their own right. Just think that's one of the hallmarks of the way we try to go over this material.
Thank you. We are very colorful and interesting.
Right.
Well, in this part, basically what we're going to do with Ralph is we are going to go into more detail into the article. This is something that we didn't do in part one because, well, we had Tom to talk us through all kinds of fascinating stuff. So because of that, the actual paper kind of got left out a bit, which is what we're going to remedy today. This paper by Weick and Roberts from 1993 is kind of structured around understanding a problem. How is it that groups of people in these very tightly, what was the word he used? Bound? No.
No, tightly. He talks about closely coupled.
Yes, thank you. Closely coupled and
highly interactive, interactively complex. So he says, He describes them as closely coupled and interactively complex, using Perrow's language.
Yes. So kind of coming back to episode 11, where we began this conversation. And the question here is the same. How is it that this type of system doesn't fail despite consisting largely of people who are very fallible?
Right. And the article goes into some detail describing the author's views on what collective mind is and how it's maintained in the organizations that they observed, which I think is very interesting from a practitioner's point of view, because I read the article in the 1990s and thought it was very insightful for things that we often take for granted in practice. And the article itself focuses on what they call HEED, which is they understand as dispositions to act with attentiveness, alertness, and care, and then conduct, which they understand as behavior that takes into account the expectations of others, and finally mind, which they believe is an integration of feeling, thinking, and willing, and all three of those parts together are part of this collective mind establishment process.
Well, what were you up to in the 90s when you read this? Because I wasn't up to much. At all.
Well, I'm sure you're up to plenty. It's just different things. So what I was up to in the
sleeping mainly, I would imagine.
Yes. So in the 1990s, I was functioning, working in my first naval shipyard, and I was just amazed by the complexity of all the different aspects of the work that was being done. And one of the things that struck me initially, besides the complexity, is how the complexity is managed and the processes that are in place for that. And I was doing some research on Wyke's writing. And one of the things that members of the crew of ships will often observe is that when they go into a shipyard, things that are for which a single person may be responsible on the ship is widely, the activities are widely distributed from leadership and control perspectives in the shipyard. So they often find that frustrating and disconcerting because it means they have to coordinate with more people and the communications are more complex. So articles like this help give me some better understanding of why that coordination is necessary and some of the ways it comes about.
Right. So there are three cornerstones around which this article is based. So contributions, which is to do with actions that people do in this collective mind. Then representation, which is understanding that it's not just them who do the actions, it's also other people. And the interrelation of their actions with the system, which is subordination. So the contributions, representations, and subordination is what enacts, if you will, this collective mind in organizations.
So one of the things I think, before we go into the detail there, I think it's interesting that Wyke and Roberts observe in the article that this trio of the cornerstones you talk about are part of what they call the mechanisms or the means by which organizations that care a lot about reliability aggregate their mental processes that are more fully developed in these kinds of organizations than when you're strictly concerned by efficiency. Because of my orientation in high reliability, I noticed that many times that organizations that really are just concerned with getting things done very quickly and moving on to the next thing don't use these tools. And because of my experience, I noticed immediately when that's the case or when they encounter problems and how quickly they'll just move on to the next thing. So I think that's a very interesting aspect where Wyke and Roberts contrast this from the point of view of reliability versus efficiency.
I think part of that has to do with just the sheer amount of effort that actually goes into developing this reliability within a social system.
I agree. I mean, it takes some extra effort, and the coordination mechanisms, while they are often part of the way people do business in highly reliable organizations, they do take effort, and they're not easy to sustain or develop if you're not doing them. And that's sort of a barrier to entry for some organizations. But I think part of the thinking that may not be the best way to approach this, that organizations currently very focused on efficiency have, is that they look at, say, this fully developed approach to reliability that organizations like aircraft carriers use, and they think they have to do everything all at once like that. Whereas it actually starts. You start a little bit at a time, and Wyke and Roberts in the article talk a lot about how newcomers are brought into the system. And that certainly suggests you can be part of a highly reliable organization as a newcomer if the people with some experience help you out. But also implies that you don't have to start doing everything at a high level all at once. So I thought that was intriguing.
That's an interesting point. And just looking at these three things even, it almost seems that they are ordered hierarchically. That, you know, the contribution, the representation, and subordination, that may almost be like the three steps towards high reliability, because, you know, the initial one is being able to do the job, essentially, so individual training. And, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, but this is sort of how I'm interpreting what you said on the article.
I think that's a good way to say it. Yeah. In fact, it occurs to me when you said that this sort of hierarchy may not exactly be what Wyke and Roberts intended, but I really agree with you. I think that's a good point. And as I think back about it, whether it's naval aviation or in the nuclear safety kind of aspects I've been involved with, that's actually one of the first things you emphasize to the new people is this, the importance of contribution, that everybody plays a role, and even the new people do, and that you must get through the initial training so you can be a contributor. And I never really thought of it that way, but I think that's really important, because you really can't do these other parts unless you're able to contribute.
Right. So it's not the throwing in at the deep end kind of approach that
no, we don't do that.
On the job training.
No. Yeah. In fact, we actually give a lot of thought to that, both in flight decks and other aspects of carrier operations, where we have these entry-level roles that people can fulfill, and as they're developing expertise and capability, and then we have a progression through gradually more highly skilled positions, so that by the time you get to be a supervisor over a course of several years, you've actually functioned in all the subordinate levels and understand only how to help them, but what their role is and how they integrate. And that even applies to the junior officers that we have that are nominally in charge of the control rooms in the propulsion plant.
It's something like what Tom said, that when, and I think you as well, that in order to become a captain of an aircraft carrier, you kind of have to be both the aviator and a sailor.
Yes. In fact, I've heard commanding officers describe that what's one of their most important roles is understanding not only how to operate the ship and the part, all that goes into that, but also being responsive to the needs of the air crews and the air wing. You know, that when the squadrons come aboard, it's actually a separate organization, autonomous from the commanding officer, and it's commanded by the air wing commander. And the CEOs of the ships have said, because they're aviators, they have a lot of insight into what the air group needs and how to support them. So not only is he the mayor of a small city, but unlike the mayor of a small city, he's also the person in charge of the airport. And you never see that in a small city where the mayor also runs the airport, unless it's a very, very small city indeed.
It certainly highlights the importance of cross-training at these initial stages, definitely, I think.
Right.
Kind of reminds me of this idea of legitimate peripheral participation by...
Oh, yes. Laban Wenger.
Yeah. And the principle that you kind of get into it slowly while learning the craft and getting to know the norms and principles. But I guess here the added twist is that you get to experience the craft of a number of different types.
Yes.
Rather than just the one.
Yes.
Then following from that, the second step would be, so the individuals have been trained to do the basic thing that they need to do. And then second step is to get them working in collectives. So
yes.
Organized, cooperated activity, i.e. the representation, as is mentioned in the paper.
Right. Well, and there's a fascinating description or anecdote from the paper that I read recently again, and I really encourage our readers to refer to it, where they're either interviewing or just have a record of an aviator's comments about how at night when you are recovered, they say you don't actually land on aircraft carrier, you are recovered. And Wyke and Roberts use that term intentionally, because landing presumes, okay, the pilot just puts the plane on the ground, where recovery conveys this notion of lots of help and coordination and integrated effort. And the pilot was talking about after he had hit the wire and was recovered, he was then directed a taxi to a different place on the flight deck because you have to get out of the way of the landing zone since there's generally only one area where you can land. The very first priority once a plane lands is to get out of that area so that another plane can land and it wouldn't be dangerous. And the pilot's talking about how he doesn't really like taxiing at night because at night the lights are all turned down. I mean, it's really hard to describe. You know, imagine yourself camping in the dark and you just have your own little flashlight, but it's much less power than your average camping flashlight where then it comes sort of beyond the, and then you can't actually, unlike a camping flashlight where you could point it around and look at different things, on a flight deck, the lights are oriented just in kind of fixed direction. So it's not easy to see what's going on. And in fact, you cannot easily see the edge of the flight deck and where you are, particularly in a plane because you have these big planes. So he's talking about how the people with these lighted paddles are directing him to go forward. And he didn't really like the idea of going all the way forward on the flight deck and then reorienting his plane. Because as he's going over the edge of the, not the plane itself, but as he's able to look over the edge, I mean, think about maybe mountainous roads at night or something, but he can look down and see the waves. And it's basically a terrifying experience. And he thinks to himself, I hope these guys know what they're doing, you know, when they're doing this. But of course, there's this aspect of, yes, there's trust. I mean, it's not just, you know, doubtful, but he said every time he does it, it's not like he just, the way the pilot was describing it wasn't just like he took it for granted. He was grateful of all that coordination and what the people, what these are called plane spotters, but the people who are helping him, you know, get the plane in position. So it's a great anecdote about that coordination that works together. And many times it's not even with verbal communication. Many times it's just symbols and signals that are used.
I know that was an amazing example. I mean, seriously, kind of thinking of the potential consequences involved of missing by a bit. And that actually had me wondering that what would be such a degree of trust, not in the individual, because I assume that the pilot wouldn't know, didn't know, doesn't have to know the person who is taxiing him or her.
That's correct. So it's
trust into the system, or kind of to put it more tangible, into some form of training or institutional legitimacy. Basically, it's not a thing, you know.
No,
it's a made up concept that people put their trust their lives with. And I was thinking that what would be, I mean, the precedent, or even what would be a justifiable scenario where that would occur, kind of on everyday basis, because just looking at, you get the emergency workers trusting in their equipment and training as well, but justifiably, why would they?
You know? Right. Well, I'll give you a couple of examples. I think that's a good example, I think, talking about emergency workers and also trusting in each other. So not just their equipment, but each other, and that each knows what role they play and how they function together as a team. So I think that was good. The other, I think, perhaps more common example would just be to think about driving an automobile. Many times there's a lot of unspoken communication that goes on between people. And you might consider, for example, signaling a lane change, or basically someone staying in their lane on a highway at night. For example, I was driving, I don't remember which number motorway it was, but we were driving from London towards Cardiff at night, and the roads weren't very, you know, I don't want to say they weren't well lighted, but it was a bit dark. I mean, that's kind of the best way to say it. But this was a main road, so there were some lights on it, but it was not very bright. And then up ahead, there's this, you know, I can see the bridge, the outline of the bridge and the lights, but basically the high speed, people staying in their lanes, you know, not changing lanes on top of you, you know, those kinds of things. There's a high degree, not necessarily trust in the individuals, but trust in the systems, that people are trained enough that they're going to signal before they change lanes, they're going to pay attention, you know, those kinds of things. You have to be alert, of course, for those not to happen. But we end up having putting a lot of trust in the system. I think otherwise, driving, that was a little bit nerve-wracking for me because it was a new road. I'd never been down this path before. It was dark. I didn't have a lot that I could recognize. So everything was unfamiliar to me. And you certainly wouldn't want that experience every time you go driving, you know, it being night in unrecognizable country and driving, in my case, on the left-hand side of the road, which I'll say for the purpose of the podcast is the correct side to be on. And so I think that's part of that's sort of a more everyday example where the people may take for granted that those kinds of, that kind of coordination activity has to occur all the time.
So that refers to, yeah, that's actually a great example. I remember reading somewhere where a flight instructor was surprised why people are scared of flying, but not scared of driving at high speed, just a meter or 2 meters away from other such fast moving,
yes,
heavy machinery.
Yes.
And that refers to the representation then, I guess.
I think right? So.
Understanding that system consists of connected actions of both you and others around you, and that you are, in fact, part of the same system as you would be with
a driving process, right? Or a system of coordination for driving, right? And one of the things I was thinking about when I was describing the fact that people were staying in their lanes and I was able to, you know, stay in my lane and concentrate on kind of where I was supposed to go, but also my position with respect to other vehicles was when those kind of norms or expectations are violated, it's borderline terrifying, just like the pilot was describing in the article. And I was the first day I had a rental car in New Zealand. We were driving down the highway from the city where we were staying, and somebody was coming down from at high speed from a lane I don't think I really expected. And it was just before I was going to go in the lane. I think I was signaling, I'm not really sure, but he was going so fast, I didn't even see him coming up on me. And then, so the next thing I knew, he's whizzing by, you know, just as I'm about to go into the other lane. And that was very emotionally jarring. I mean, I you know, in fact, I think I yelped or something, and my wife looked at me and said, "What's wrong?" And I said, "Well, I never even saw that guy coming, and here I was about to change lane." So when those expectations or those systems are violated, and whether it's because you're not paying attention or the other person is, and that probably is irrelevant, it is a jarring experience.
That is highly unnerving.
Yes.
So, I mean, these two seem to be fairly straightforward, that, you know, you have to have people who know what they're doing, at least to a basic level, and then they have to recognize that that they are part of this coordinated activity.
Right, through recognized symbols, yep.
But the last one, the subordination, which refers to interrelate their actions within the system, I think that's maybe where the barrier may be with regards to actualizing a high reliability organization. That basically refers to this implicit both hierarchy and coordination of many different levels of activity. So in the paper, they give an example of when a number of different specialists coordinate a plane launch, right, or recovery.
Right. Yeah, and that's actually a good example where all these, so there's lots of, I don't want to say smaller, but sub-layers involved in this that Wyke and Roberts didn't even talk about. The mechanisms that the individual groups use to coordinate their activities within their part. And then they have these, one of the ways that I think high reliability organizations or any organization really can get these activities and subgroups to coordinate is having established protocols for how you, say, pass off to the other system. And so they didn't really talk about that in the context of recovery of a plane, but they did talk about it is in the description of the pilot taxiing from the landing zone, where as soon as he's landed, he is trained to look at the people with the paddles because they're going to tell him where to go because he knows he can't stay there. He doesn't know where he's supposed to go because that's actually an emergent property of flight deck coordination. And that kind of stuff can change all the time based on a plane needed to be fueled or rearmed or having a pilot problem. And they talk later in the article about some of those complexities. So the pilot's trained to look for that. And at the same token, you know, he's aware that there's other risks and dangers out there that he's supposed to pay attention to, but at night he can't. And so there are these pass-off signals, right? So for example, if he didn't know to look up and follow directions of the person with the paddles, the lighted paddles, that would be chaos, right? And so that's part of what the high reliability organizations do. I mean, we did the same thing in the propulsion plant where we would talk about we would do, since a lot of the things that you do are repetitive, even though they're repetitive, you'll bring people together and say, here's how we're going to do this. So everybody has a pretty good mental picture of the next thing they're going to do. And then we will often talk about, and you'll know I'm ready when I say this. We will actually talk about the communications. We don't always do that because just doesn't happen every single time. But many times we do. And particularly if it's something that's not done frequently, that's an essential part of it, is knowing what information the other person knows. And a quick story here is, so at my first nuclear-powered ship, I was doing what we call starting up the plant, which is basically bringing the steam into the machinery spaces and starting rotating machinery that turn with steam turbines. And
you weren't pulling on a string repeatedly?
No. it was not a wind-up toy. and so one of the supervisors from outside the control room came in to me, because this was not part of my training and qualifications. And he came in to me and he says, here's what I want to hear from you. I want to know these things. So when this is happening, I want to hear some kind of, announcement that says this. So that, then he says, and I'll use that to do this. And it struck me when he was telling me, I was thinking, I never heard any of this stuff when I was qualifying. And I wasn't angry. I was just interested that sort of communication was left out of all the manuals and procedures in the training process. And in fact, so you have this image, well, I'm qualified and I'm trained to do this and I can contribute. Then you find out, no, not really, because those coordination processes are an essential part of your training. So essentially, what my training had accomplished was it earned me the right to sit in the seat I was in the control room, and to be in that particular role. But it didn't mean I knew everything. And so my training had to continue. And this is much the same way that a driver's license for a vehicle could be considered as a license to learn, is what some experienced people have told.
That is, I think, excellent, seriously. You don't get to be an expert once you qualify. You just get to be able to practice what it is that you're qualified in and learn further.
Right. One of the things you have to teach people in high reliability organizations is don't get too confident. Because you've passed the exam and because you've been through the trials and you have all this knowledge, because there's much more to be learned in the integration processes. Because really, I think we were talking about this earlier, you can't put those things in books. That integration process actually has to be learned through practice. I imagine you could try to write it down, but I don't know if that would be very effective. It's like the management theories we were talking about earlier, right? You you could learn to describe them. But unless you've seen them in practice, it's really hard to know, well, where are they applicable? When do they not work? What are some of the risks and benefits of using them? Those kinds of things.
Right. But there are inherent risks associated with having inexperienced newcomers.
Oh, yes.
Interact with these highly complex and risky systems, right?
Yes.
This is what you specialize in, adult learning.
And that's what I find it so interesting, is because Wyke and Roberts talk about in the article about the role that the experienced people have to help the newcomers, and not just in this integration process, but also to help them understand the larger system that they fit into. And in fact, one of the things that was occurring to me, it's not in the article, but as a newcomer, it's not easy to get the people who have the experience to just disgorge their knowledge about, all the things they know. Because many times they don't actually think of it all the time themselves. So Wyke and Roberts talk about when newcomers are getting this information and this socialization, it is a social process from the experienced people, they said it has a sort of a dual benefit, because not only does it help the less experienced, but just talking about it may remind people with greater experience of things they were taking for granted or hadn't thought about recently. And in fact, I've heard people who are experienced describing that, and that's in fact actually what does happen. But the first point I was going to make was, as a junior person, you just can't go to somebody's experience and say, well, tell me how you do this, or tell me what you think of. And any more than you could go to an experienced academic and say, well, tell me how you come up with an idea for a research paper. How do you write? It doesn't mean they couldn't talk to you about it, but that's a difficult way to start. So in the propulsion plant, we have this expression called runtime, almost like it's a machine. And so you might say, well, when a machine is operating, you refer to its runtime, how many hours it's been operating. But in the socialization process, it means something very specific. It means a junior person going to a senior person and not exactly just asking them questions, but engaging in a dialogue about what the junior person's understanding is of some process or procedure or aspect of operations. And then getting the senior person to give them feedback and comment and and have a dialogue back and forth about some of these more sophisticated and important sublayers. You know, teaching junior people how to ask for runtime and what that really involves is another part of the socialization process that I think is very important for adult learning and improving reliability.
So just off the top of my head, there is an assumption here that this is how it's supposed to happen, but there are many instances documented in the literature where people do not, as you pointed out, share their knowledge and experience freely, not because they can't necessarily articulate it, but because there's a political dimension associated with such issues as knowledge is both power but also legitimacy.
Yes,
but,
absolutely. The basic view, and this is mostly the experience I have from the organizations I've been in, is that knowledge is power, but only when other people have it. And so it is actually not a good thing for you to have this group of senior experts where that's, you know, that's all they can go do. I mean, it's good to have that capability, but you don't want to put all your faith and confidence in just these few people, because you do need these newcomers to be socialized into the process. So there's a very strong ethic of knowledge sharing and grooming new people and helping them get acculturated. And in fact, I used to explicitly focus on this when I was the reactor officer on aircraft carrier in charge of the entire propulsion system in the nuclear reactors. I used to go to the officers and said, look, if you want to get contributions from your team, you shouldn't just expect that it will happen. You actually have to solicit it. And this is something that, once again, is part of the socialization process. And I talk about things like creating the psychological safety for people to contribute, because the downside or the dark side of this very high competence level the senior people have is there tends to be what I call an air of technological snobbery, where that people say, well, I know more than you, so you shouldn't, you know, contribute, or you should just be quiet while I'm talking. And you really can't stamp that out. I mean, that's just going to exist amongst humans. So I used to talk about making that space for people to contribute, and that would help break down some of those barriers. But that's a very real danger you deal with, is in some organizations that don't pay much attention to that, the junior people often end up not being able to contribute as effectively. And you see it in their performance level suffering.
That's interesting. Just as a side note, that this is very much like what was the problem facing the early scientific management, that people were technically snobbish about the way that they would operate their machines. And that was one of the things that...
Yeah, absolutely. And so that's a barrier to sort of interdependence if people think that their interests are better served by not cooperating. But that's actually an important cultural aspect of higher reliability organizations that often isn't discussed, is this idea that everybody needs to contribute. And it's not just, you don't just lay that out to people. It's often done through the reviews of problems that we know, we call them critiques, but you can call them anything, where you're looking at a problem that occurred and then trying to analyze what could be done differently. So there's that actual problem analysis aspect. But then, presuming you have an effective process and you can understand some things to improve on, the next step is taking the things that you've learned and spreading them widely so that others can benefit from them. And so there's that aspect of recognizing that the collective mind is improved by the sharing of these ideas and this these interactions, where you actually, it's not just a case of saying, well, Demetrius, I learned this and you should do that, right? It's actually expected to be a dialogue where I talk about the things that surprise me, and then I listen to, you know, for what your reaction is, and we talk about it, where you can contribute in that process, even if it's less experienced. It's that interaction, and Wyken Roberts talk about this a great deal, about that interaction and social process that occurs that helps reinforce this idea that knowledge actually is more powerful when it's shared.
Right, and there are two items there. One is that they invoke the what's called a transactive memory system, which is essentially a principle that the two of us can figure more things out than each of us individually, because we can, well, do what you just described. And also we can point to likely places where we would be able to learn more on the given problem.
Yes.
But also then there's the sharing of knowledge across both time and space. So with space especially, that... and they covered this slightly in the paper in passing, because an aircraft carrier, or let's say an isolated organization, maybe like what we discussed in episode 13, sure, you learn and things are learned within it, but then there is no direct link to another such organization, right? So with an aircraft carrier, you have everyone on board and they don't really interact with another aircraft carrier. And then they gave this example of a person who was hugely experienced, many, many years of experience of, I think, organizing the flight deck or something like that.
Yes.
And he came in and he reduced the operations time. Basically, he improved it threefold.
Yes, it was from 6 hours to 2 hours and just a little.
Yeah, and that was just one person doing that.
Well, it wasn't just one person, right? Because the way we think of it is that, you know, he had to convince other people this was the way to go do it and then getting the teams to function effectively. But he had, you know, he had a lot of ideas about. And so, yeah, isn't it kind of interesting there where you would think, oh, that would be standard across aircraft carriers. Everybody would be doing it, you know, some particular way. And yet this person came in and had the insight to say, hey, this, you know, these ways you aren't are doing it are not very effective. And one of the things I was thinking about during the reading of the article was that one of the big challenges the U.S. Navy faces is because its ships and aircraft go through cycles of maintenance and operations and training, that it is actually possible for some of these things to be collectively forgotten, and the behaviors and routines have to be reestablished. And one of the big challenges that I was learning as a person operating in the shipyard was that you can't just turn that on, that, you know, that performance on and off with a switch. You have to actually build time into your maintenance schedule, which is hard to explain to outsiders, that part of the maintenance process is providing opportunities for the crew to behave and operate and redevelop their skill. And of course, if you explain it in terms of like a soccer player or a football player coming back from injury, or somebody who's had a long illness, you know, restarting what they're doing, I think people would get that. But it's interesting. And when it comes to maintenance, people often act like, you know, the outsiders often act like, well, no, that's not part of maintenance. You know, you shouldn't be doing that. And in fact, your credibility is sometimes questioned when you say, no, I'm building in some time for training. It takes a lot of time and effort to convince people. That's not negotiable. It must be done. Because if you don't, the crew performance will suffer and it'll still impact your schedule. So I thought that's one of the interesting paradoxes about maintenance and operations.
It is interesting. And it is a common issue with projects as such, that when projects disperse at completion, then there is a high likelihood of learnings and knowledge and experience being sort of dissipated into the ether, so to speak.
Right. So you're talking about that temporal aspect of the coordinations and the interrelations. If you don't take the time to do that, then your ability to propagate your knowledge across space and time is severely diminished. That's one of the reasons why the aviators are really, really good because they'll often have flight crews, and this is particularly in commercial aviation, but also in military, where they don't work together all the time. And so the aviators are really good about doing what they call a post-flight debrief, where they'll actually get together as a small group and hierarchy largely is not involved. And they talk about what did go well, what didn't go well. The Army does something very similar. They call it an after-action review. And the whole goal after some big complex operation is to get the junior people to speak up, because the Army, implicit in this, the idea of the after-action review, is that the senior people don't know everything and will never know everything. And yet, a lot of the really good information is in the minds of the other people, the subordinate people. And you are not going to know about it if you can't get it out of their mind. So they create these social processes. And so a bunch of it is the process of an after action review or a debrief is social, in that you want to get everybody contributing.
This is actually mirrored in how strategy consultancies work as well, that a lot of the times the first point of contact during the initial problem formulation is to go to frontline staff, so yes, to speak, to the secretaries and ask them what the problems are with the organization. And usually that is most of the issue would be found out. I'm very curious to kind of explore another thing, is that so we're talking about how the knowledge sharing and reenactment of skills and capabilities functions. And you gave some excellent examples. And then we can turn our attention to traditionally bureaucratic places, which are almost the exact opposite. It feels that they're almost hamstrung by inability to reenact skills and expertise, and yet they're not that dissimilar in many ways. There's also the basic skill set that is required to participate, then there's the group and teamwork, probably some degrees of subordination, interrelating your actions with those of the wider system, except maybe the interrelation happens at a procedural level rather than at a level of practice, as it seems to be occurring within higher liability organizations. But I'm very curious to get your take on that, as mine is theoretical mainly.
Well, I think you have some points. Aircraft carriers have their bureaucratic aspects as well. I mean, what Wyke and Roberts are describing in the article were really the operational aspects of performance and planes taxiing around, but there's a lot of other things that occur at the same time. So how they coordinate meals and how you request permission to do, you know, various things and write procedures and get concurrence for the next port you're going to go into, you know, those kinds of things. And so there's a lot of process procedure like knowledge or activity that you're talking about, And I think it's interesting you bring that up because I think you have a point that a lot of the standard approaches to bureaucracy, if that makes any sense, or a lot of things, what you see in bureaucracy, don't have those more vibrant social aspects. They're more procedural related. So if you're in a real time or a real world example would be if you're trying to get help from a company through tech support and you're asking for assistance or you're having a problem, doesn't fit into one of their common buckets. It's very difficult for them to help you because it's hard for them to even recognize the nature of the problem. And so I do think I don't think it has to be that way in bureaucracy, but many times the organizations don't think about, well, what's the smartest way to do this, or where are we having problems, or let's analyze what's wrong with this particular way of doing business. And that's, you were talking about consultancy. And that's a lot of where the power of Lean and Six Sigma and those kinds of organizational development, organizational improvement tools come from, is they actually take that kind of operations focus to their bureaucratic procedures. And they say, well, why are we doing it this way? Or, you know, who needs this information? And they start thinking about it more at an operations level. Who needs the next? In fact, Toyota does this. I've been reading some articles about this for some other work I'm doing. And Toyota and the people who work there developed this process of analyzing systems that would normally look very bureaucratic and process control, but asking very detailed questions like, how do you know to do this? Where do you get your inputs from? Who gets what you do? The next step. And so they take something that is what you would initially think was just bureaucracy, right? I mean, it's how the things get put on pallets and on the back of the truck so it can be departed. But the way Toyota will analyze this process is more like an operational view, and that lends all sorts of insights to things that people just don't think about very much. And so I think that's where some of the negative connotations of bureaucracy come in, where there's this sort of unthinking aspect where you can't change the procedures. And I'll give you a perfect example. Well, not a perfect example. I will give you an example from my time.
Give me the perfect one.
Well, I'll do my best. So I'll give my time in shipyards, right? So shipyards have lots of bureaucracy and lots of extra rules, many more than I was used to seeing aboard ship. And that I found that, I don't want to say bewildering, because I'm used to just basically opening the books and studying and taking notes. So I didn't find that to be a real problem. But one day I found out that the procedures, most of the procedures that they did maintenance and coordinated the activities from, the manual was subject to revision. And you could, once you found out who was the owner, the technical owner of the manual, you could go to them and say, I need to deviate for this reason. Here's why. And here's what I want to do. And that person would give you permission. There was a formal process for this, but he'd give you permission and document it. He wouldn't necessarily change the procedure forever. But I found out through that interaction, these things that everybody else thought of as immutable and fixed, they're actually variable. And you can adjust them. But, you know, you have to make a good technical argument or operational argument. But to me, that was like having the keys to the city. Because now I didn't feel like the framework had to limit me. I mean, there's times when it does, and I understand that. But what I noticed is many of my coworkers, and particular people who had been in the shipyard for decades, to them, it was fixed. It wasn't changing. You couldn't change it. But I'd had the conversations with the engineers who said, oh yeah, I can make a local change for this. So to me, that was a fascinating insight about the way the organization worked. And they didn't, maybe on purpose, they didn't emphasize that the rules were actually much more flexible than they let on. But I thought it was a tremendous insight. You know, once I learned that, I thought, oh, you know, you can be creative. You can do different things. I don't have to, the bureaucracy does not have to channel my thinking. So I thought that was very powerful insight.
That is an excellent example. I think it nicely highlights this tension or relationship, I guess, depending how you want to see it, between the processes and the practices that organizations basically consisting of, where the practices is the activities and the processes is the rules and procedures and so forth. So, Ralph, what is the cash value of this, do you think?
Well, I think so. The cash value is to recognize that this collective mind or this group approach to coordinating complex activities, whether it's aircraft carriers or, you know, setting up an academic conference, because I could think of that would be very complicated as well. It's largely a social process, and it's in the means of what's communicated and how through the social processes that are very important. And oftentimes below the social processes are these shared meanings and language that people often don't explicitly consider. And one of the things that occurred to me from the article was that they had these four assertions or sort of operational rules to live by. Number one, if it's not written down, you can do it. Number two, look for clouds in every silver lining. Very interesting twist on the common understanding of that expression.
And it is.
Most positions on the flight deck were actually purchased in blood, because the things that you do are based on past problems. So therefore, you should think very carefully when you want to do something different. And then one of my favorites was, and I think about this all the time, because this works in real life as well. And actually, probably many of these look for may actually be applicable to conference organizing, because I'm thinking about that. The fourth one is never get into something you can't get out of.
So, sound advice indeed.
Yeah. So to me, the way I operationalize that is always have an exit strategy, right? Always have an idea of what you can do. And so my wife will often ask me, like, what are you going to do with this? I said, dear, I have like 5 plans already. I'm just not telling you all because I don't want things to get confusing. But I've thought through all the ways this can go wrong because of that clouds in every silver lining aspect. So that's what I think. I think if you could think about just some of those, so you might want to call those heuristics or rules to live by. But I think those apply in real life as well. And I tried to, you know, give some general, you know, explanations, like conference organizing, where it's a very difficult event and lots of people are involved and lots of expectations and shared understandings. That I think is the payday for this kind of article.
I like that last one. I think it might highlight some of the key differences and distinctions between this and what would traditionally be understood as bureaucracy, because as we've discussed in when we talked about Weber and since then, that bureaucracies tend to be unidirectional. They just move forward, whereas the exit plan, maybe that is one of the key elements that makes a reliable system highly reliable. And it's a good way to put it, I think.
So I think that would be helpful for our readers to pay attention to. And then, because, you know, that's covered explicitly in the article, but more like, how do these apply to me and the complex things I do? Because Charles Perrow said, you know, because certain systems are opaque and interactively complex with tight coupling, they're just too dangerous to function and operate, because you're going to have these normal accidents. And I think it's a different way to look at that is, okay, those kinds of systems exist, and in many cases, we're not about to abandon them. And therefore, what are some of the social processes that you can put in place or that you can practice that actually account for that and help you become more successful? So that's what I think another payday for the readers is.
Excellent. And that's all for episode 20.
Yes.
Thank you for listening.
Yeah, it's fun to talk about. We hope that our listeners find this approach to looking at the article fruitful.
Yeah, do have a look at the article if you haven't, and listen to Tom in part one. It's very excellent stuff. And of course, if you enjoyed this, share with your friends, or maybe take a few minutes to go on iTunes and leave us a review. Those help new people find us who may not yet be aware of us.
Right. And if you're a management or organizational science professor, share this with your class as a way of exploring and getting deeper into management theory and organizational science.
Yes, please do that, especially part one. So next week we bring you a summary of this episode, and then the week after that is the last episode of season two of this batch of episodes that we were doing since early summer, where we will focus on technology and organizations with a special guest, Barton Friedland from Deutsche Bank. So we have a practitioner on again. Very exciting.
Yes, we're looking forward to it.
Please do join us as we continue our discussions into organizations and things that make them function here on Talking About Organizations.